Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of August. The elections in Afghanistan, the first hour of our program today. Thomas Goodyear is our guest. He is Dean of International Studies and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. He's joined us several times before on this program to share his expertise. He lived and worked in Afghanistan as a Peace Corps volunteer, a Fulbright Fellow, and Executive Director of the Fulbright Foundation. He coached the Afghan national basketball team when he was there and served as senior political affairs officer on the UN peacekeeping mission to Afghanistan in 96-97. He's testified on various topics related to Afghanistan before the hearings of the U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee and the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on International Relations. He speaks, reads, and writes Afghan Persian, Iranian Persian, and Tajikistani Persian. He's written many books about Afghanistan society, culture, and politics. And to give credence to you never know where your life is going, he worked in his father's pastry shop in Ohio from ages 8 to 24, receiving his master baking certificate at the age of 18. Always good knowledge to have. Professor Thomas Goodyear, thank you for joining us again.
It's nice to be with you, Kathleen. Yeah. Thank you. I like the fact that you include that bit about the bakery and the national basketball team stuff as well.
I like it, too. It rounds out your resume, right? You never know where you're going to be going.
That's for sure.
Yeah. So what do you make of what we've heard so far? Do you get a sense that the numbers of people going to the polls is down, or do we not know that yet?
Well, I think the numbers are probably down from the numbers that we had in the 2004 and 2005 elections, but I think they're higher, better numbers than people were expecting based on the forecasts because of security issues. And in fact, this morning I have been in touch with our offices in Kabul and in Zabul, which is one of the more difficult provinces in the country, and another office in Paktika. And, the indications are that more people are getting out to vote than expectations had been. And so I think that's good. I think it speaks, well of the Afghan population's desire to participate in their own governance and the belief that they have the legacy and the right to do so. Mm-hmm. And the numbers of female voters, I understand, in the South, Kandahar in particular, are lower than in the past, but they normally are not high for females in that part of the country anyhow. They normally are higher for females in provinces like Bamyan in the center of the country, or in Kabul itself, or in provinces in the north. So we don't know, obviously, yet what the percentages are there, because the polls just closed, not too long ago. They extended the voting for an hour or two in some places because there were enough people coming in to vote that they felt that they needed to keep the polls open.
So often these days you get these incredible contrasts between life in very modern societies and life in places like Afghanistan. And I was so struck by the pictures of the donkeys in these very, very remote parts of the country delivering the ballots so people could vote.
Well, and I think, this again, testifies to the way that people believe they need to be able to exercise their right, and they'll use whatever means are available to them to be able to do that. I remember in the lead up to the 2004 elections, I was in Bamyan province, and it was very interesting to see the numbers of people that were coming out to register to vote and how they had separated it up for the women were going to a school, and across the street the men were registering at a tea house. But they were all doing it, and they were all going through this process of registration, most of them not being literate, so they had to show identity cards and things of this nature. But they were there, and they were lined up, and they were determined. And, there's every indication that where it's possible to do that, again, that is what's going on. And whether it be by donkey or by more modern means in places like Kabul, I think the Afghans have a kind of innate sense that they have the right to express themselves. That comes from their cultural heritage. The whole Han tribal structure and the village Malik structure has always had a kind of proportional representational format where people could express themselves. And I think, you know, voting in elections is an extension of that. And I think the people of Afghanistan believe they have this right. They exercised that right in 1965 and 1969 under a constitutional monarchy that was democratic at the time, and they exercised it in 2004 and 5, and they're trying to do it now. And you have to admire them, because it's not as easy as hopping in one's car and going off right to the nearest polling booth here and voting.
It sure isn't. Tell me about this incredibly large number of people who are running for president. It's what, 40? 41? Unbelievable.
It is unbelievable. And I have to tell you that I know many of them. And, you know, and I think the fact that there is this number is, again, a testimony to the fact that the Afghans are going to be engaged in this whole process. And what this does, of course, is it covers a pretty broad spectrum of people, an ethnic, makeup of the country, as well as a regional distribution. So that means there's a focus throughout the country in different places on these elections, and people are campaigning. They may not be really viable candidates in terms of prospects for winning, but they're out there and they're campaigning, and that I think shows again the commitment of the population to engage in their own governance. And I was kind of amazed by the number as well. And in the end, there were probably only two or three really viable candidates. Viability meaning the prospects that they would get into at least a runoff or double digits in a percentage of people coming to vote for them.
So tell me, what are the chances are that President Karzai will emerge the victor? Who are his strongest opponents?
Well, his strongest opponent, it appears right now, is an individual by the name of Dr. Abdullah. We've added another Abdullah to his name, so it becomes Abdullah, because in the West, of course, we always have to have more than one name. But in Afghanistan, he's always been Dr. Abdullah. And he has emerged as the most, I think, viable contender, because he has the grassroots from the population in the North, and those who identified with the Northern Alliance that was led by this very prominent Afghan Mujahid or freedom fighter who fought against the Soviets, Ahmad Shah Massoud. As most people know, he was killed 2 days before 9/11 because the Al-Qaeda and ISI of Pakistan and Taliban network knew that if the United States came after them after an event like 9/11, the last person they wanted to have associated with the United States coming after them was this Ahmad Shah Massoud, a very highly regarded Afghan commander during the fight against the Soviets. Well, Dr. Abdullah has a lot of that support. Hamid Karzai is from the south. He's a Pashtun. He's a tribal Khan. And he's going to have that kind of grassroots support. Plus, he has the value that incumbency brings to an election, sure, and recognition. And he is by far and away the most recognized name in the country. But Dr. Abdullah's name is becoming more recognized. He's using television. He's having big rallies, and I think just if you analyze it going into today, based on grassroots, you'd have to assume that these were going to be the two who were going to be emerging. All polls that have been taken to this date also suggest that. There are a couple others who were developing some interest. One individual who was noted for focusing on reform, anti-corruption, a fellow by the name of Bashar Dost. He was coming up and gaining more attention, but still only in single digits. And then there was another individual, a kind of technocrat by the name of Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, who had been involved in the previous governments under Karzai, so he was running. So they were the top four projected candidates. So it'll be interesting now to see what the percentages yield.
Yes. We have phone calls coming in. Let's go to them. Our number is 800-486-8655. The elections in Afghanistan, our topic this hour with Professor Thomas Goodyear, Dean of International Studies, Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. And we start our phone calls with Jake from Menasha. Hi, Jake. You're on the air. Jake, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah, go right ahead.
I had to turn my radio down.
Oh, okay.
Kathleen, great show, great guest. My question to the guest is, how honest does he believe this election, the results of this election, will be in terms of, is it really an honest election, or is it just, is this all spin?
Right. Well, I think that's a valid question in any kind of thing, particularly among those countries that are still practicing the process of voting, getting into the mood. And I think it's always good for us to go back and take a look at our own history. And a lot of people used to ask the same question when we had our initial votes and during the time of Washington and Adams and Jefferson, et cetera. And that process is always a developmental one. I think it's developmental in Afghanistan. And I have no doubts that there will be some efforts by people who particularly think they can curry favor with one candidate or another to help, make votes greater than they might honestly be. But I think also the fact of the matter is that there's a strong sense among the Afghans that they want these to be viable elections. And it's not going to be, an easy walk for anybody who's trying to subvert the process. Afghans are a very independent-minded people. First of all, I have to say they're also exceedingly hospitable people, contrary to what maybe some might feel because of the fact that we're in a very turbulent time in Afghanistan. But the reason I kept going back there, as Kathleen described in the introduction, was because they're really enjoyable people to be with, to work with, and you admired them for their strong sense of independence, but you really appreciated their uncommon hospitality. It's that strong sense of independence that I think will, in the end, prevail in the greatest percentages of polling places, and people will be mindful of that. I'm not going to claim that there will be no voter fraud or there will be no dishonest efforts, but there's a history in almost every country, even our own, where there are questions about that. We can go back to the Kennedy race in 1960
sure.
in Chicago, the Bush race in 2000 in Florida, and all these kinds of things that come up. Elections are valuable things. They mean a lot. They bring much to the winners and even to the losers. They bring the recognition and the opportunity to participate in society and means that would not have been available to them. So I'm sure there are going to be attempts to influence and maybe even buy elections that, or votes that will be reported. But I think on the balance, my experience with the Afghans, and I've had experience now, this will be the fourth major election of this kind that I've had experience going back to 1965, is that they treasure the right to participate in their governance. And so we'll hear of dishonest acts and fraudulent votes, etc. But I think on the balance, we should see that this is a a valid election.
Anything else, Jake?
Follow-up.
Sure.
How does one address all these voter ballots, not voter ballots, but voter things that you can buy in the streets? You can buy the moron mass media's reporting. You can buy voter authorizations in the street for $10, $12, $20, $100, you know, $500. How is that addressed?
Well, I don't know how that is going to be addressed. First of all, the fact that you have to buy them means that, you know, there may be some who have a lot of money or who are supporting candidates and who could be doing that. That sounds a little bit to me like some of the things we heard about in big boss politics in the United States. How do you address that? It takes time, and I think it takes a rule of law over time to ensure that that doesn't become a part of the normal electoral process in any given country. I think the people who vote demand that in the long term. How do you do that in the short term? I don't know how. Supposed to be means by which every person who is coming to vote is going to be able to be judged a legitimate voter, and so you hope that process itself will prevail. But again, as I indicated earlier, Jake, in my comments, there will be, I think, some of these things that will go on. It's a testing of the process, and one does not have immediately in a country like Afghanistan, which has a limited experience in the voting process, an immediate 100% correct process. And we don't have that in any country where there's democratic process. There's always someone trying to do something somehow or other. And you'll see more of it in countries like Afghanistan. We saw it in Iran recently as well. At a time when, leading up to this last election in Iran, everybody thought that elections in Iran were pretty viable, pretty honest. And then all of a sudden, people who were running in Iran with Ahmadinejad, who were backed by Khamenei, they did the Watergate thing. You know, in other words, they went for overkill. And they tried to do whatever they could to eliminate any viability in their opposition. And that put the whole question of how elections go in Iran and now into grave question. And we'll have to see what happens in Afghanistan with the process today. I know Hamid Karzai and Dr. Abdullah and Ashraf Ghani, by the way, well enough myself to know that as individuals, they're essentially disposed towards more, to human rights and honesty, but they're running for election. Things happen in elections, and let's just hope that the more honest parts of it prevail.
Thank you, Jake, very much for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the elections in Afghanistan. I'm interested in getting Tom's assessment of the Taliban and the insurgent forces in the country and whether or not they are gaining strength or they're losing strength. And, of course, we'll have to get an assessment of how U.S. troops and NATO troops are faring in the country as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you would like to send an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. The elections, of course, are going on today. The election officials in the country kept the polls open for an extra hour after fears of violence evidently kept some potential voters from participating. President Karzai is seeking re-election, facing challenges from nearly 40 rivals. Two more of your phone calls and more discussion in a moment. Yeah, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The second hour of our program today, we'll be speaking with the authors of Tears in the Darkness, the story of the Bataan Death March and its aftermath. Our guests are Michael Norman and Elizabeth Norman, and we'll also be speaking with one of the survivors of that march, who is now 91 years old. It was an incredibly brutal act and a dark chapter in human history. We'll talk about it the second hour of our show. The elections in Afghanistan this hour. Feel free to join us. You're quiet this morning. Maybe you're following the results of this, but I know that on frequent there have been frequent requests for more programs on Afghanistan, and we had an interesting conversation, as you'll recall, with Christiane Amanpour, who did that CNN special that was on, I believe, last week, that looked at Afghanistan and other countries, and thought she had great focus on some of the wonderful projects that are taking place there. Our guest is Tom Goodyear, Dean of International Studies and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. Can you give us, and I don't know how we get this, because it is hard to report from Afghanistan, Tom, but can you tell me what your assessment is of how strong the insurgent forces and the Taliban are right now? Are they gaining strength or losing strength or what?
Well, I think they were gaining strength, and I think that was had as much to do with the fact that the whole reconstruction and development of Afghanistan, in which we were participating along with the Afghans, just was coming to a kind of a gridlock in a sense, and a lot that the Afghans had been expecting hadn't been obtained, and they didn't see any real prospects for that coming about because of the decline in security. And when expectations are kind of dashed, people recoil, they retract, and they are less. I think willing to come out and demonstrate their support for a process. I think one of the great things on that show that you mentioned, Kathleen, Christiane Amanpour show, the thing that I enjoyed most seeing was were the sections about the youth of Afghanistan, the way they were, you know, deciding to go ahead with their youthful lives, you know, with Afghan Star television show and things of this nature, just which was more a demonstration again of the spirit of youth and their determination, and in some ways it kind of has lifted my spirits about you know, the prospects for the future. I think that in the last year, and particularly now with the new leadership that we have with Gates and Petraeus and McChrystal in Afghanistan in a military sense, it was smart, I think, of President Obama to utilize, to retain Gates, who I think came to a quick understanding that the policies of his predecessor, you know, were failing, and he started to work towards turning those around in the last year under Bush, and with Petraeus's help. I think it was smart for them for Obama to retain them. We have continuity. We have a policy now that seems to be focused and understanding that this is going to be a long-term effort, that we got distracted by the Iraqi experience, and that Afghanistan really is more critical to our long-term interest, and they're focusing in that way. I'm encouraged by this, and I know some Afghans are starting to sense that too. We have members of our center here who go back and forth all the time, and my assistant director just recently returned, and you know, he had the negative points, but he also said some things were happening. And today we talked to two of our office staff, one in Zabul, which is in the heart of the Pashtun area, the other one in Kabul. They both, by the way, each votes or prefers a different candidate, but they were both excited about the way they felt the elections went today. And so, you know, the window, the doors are still open for us to, I think, turn our effort around and make it more focused, more coordinated. The Afghans have too many messengers coming to them, too many different countries, too many different approaches, and it needs to be more focused, more coordinated. We need to take more direct charge. I think we're starting to do that. And as a result, I think Afghans are sensing that as well. They're quick to sense that. And the strength of the Taliban is going to be calculated mostly against the lack of strength that we might have in our program. So the Afghans don't want these people in charge of their country, but they're afraid of them. And their power to intimidate by threatening with night letters under the door or threatening families if their girls go to school is very, very strong.
Sure. Let's go back to phone calls. Richard from Fort Atkinson. Hi. Richard? Are you there, Richard? All right, we'll try again. Art from Madison. Hi, Art.
Professor, you mentioned that the Pakistan ISI was involved in the killing of Massoud 2 days before 9/11. Could you describe exactly what you believe was the what happened on 9/11, and why are we blaming the Afghans for 9/11?
Well, I appreciate that question because I think we should not, of course, blame the Afghans for 9/11. The Afghan population was held hostage, really, by that what I call the unholy alliance of the Pakistani Inter Services Intelligence Organization, the ISI, and by their Taliban, clients and Al Qaeda. And all of the 19 people who were participating in our 9/11 events in the attacks were not a one of them, of course, was from Afghanistan. The reason people, I think, feel that Afghanistan was the was involved in this in any way is because those who did participate in those attacks had their training in camps in Afghanistan. So the Afghans under the Taliban were seen as hosting these individuals. But that doesn't mean that the population, of course, of Afghanistan was involved in that, nor in favor of that. And all of the individuals who were involved were from other countries, mostly from countries in the Persian Gulf. And I think it's a mistake to think that the Afghans were complicit in this. The thing about Ahmad Shah Massoud, he was so widely respected, I think, as a military mind that the ISI and Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, who had been fighting against him, were aware that if had he the resources that the United States would bring into this, that would be a very formidable combination. And he was indeed a brilliant tactician, and he knew how to lead. And so that's why I think they were that combination of that unholy alliance, as I call them, were determined that he was going to be out of the way. It's a mistake. I think you said your name was Art. For people to assume that the Afghans were part of this. In fact, the Afghans knew that when 9/11 occurred, that the United States is going to have to come back to their country, we having left that country after the Soviets left, not really focusing on it anymore. And that as a result, they had a chance for the future. And they continue to feel that way. They're our biggest asset in this struggle against the globalization of terrorism, the Afghans. They really do want us there. We just have to do a better job of what we're doing and help them to do a better job of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about that. Why do you think they're our biggest asset?
Well, because they really do want us there, Kathleen. You know, throughout the period of time that we were in Iraq, there was at least ambiguity about sure. How welcomed we were there, in that country. And even for those who were glad to see Saddam Hussein gone, there was a lot of at least ambiguity, I like to use the term, about our presence there. That's not the case in Afghanistan. Those who don't want us in Afghanistan, who are Afghan, have other political agendas that are holdovers from this period when the Taliban were trying to take over the country as part of this whole concerted jihadi movement that incorporates the Al-Qaeda network and incorporated this ISI. What has happened, unfortunately, is that because of the fact that the development and reconstruction of Afghanistan, the restoration of security has not progressed as effectively as it should have, is that this has led to the development of kind of regional, local warlords and militias. And these individuals sometimes are insurgent because this is the way they know how to voice their opinion. You got to remember that many of these people have spent their whole lives living in this kind of insurgent experience and mentality. Similarly, those in the tribal areas of Pakistan. So how do we break that? That's the big challenge. And how do we make them feel that they're being incorporated into their own governance? And there are different groups around Afghanistan who don't feel they are. And this is part of a long-term cultural, social, political history of Afghanistan, a history that during the 50s, 60s, and 70s was moving towards more homogenization. It was not yet an homogenized country by any stretch. That all dissipated during the period after the Soviet invasion, and when everybody kind of parochialized and started fighting in their own areas. A lot of those people are remaining behind. They want to make sure that they're going to be incorporated into their future.
Mm-hmm. And tell me more about the process of voting here. If you get what percentage of the vote here today, and if you don't get it, then winner runoffs?
Well, you know, you hear various things. I've heard some people saying there has to be at least a 30% turnout. Others said, well, in the past, during that first election, there was something like a 70% turnout. That's hard to call. When you factor threats to one's family, one's own self, into the election process, that's going to have an impact. And I think that, you know, everybody's just hoping for, you know, a number sufficient to indicate that there are people going out there. I think, you know, when we take a look at our own regional elections, I mean, I know recently here in Omaha, you know, we had elections and we didn't get 30%, turnout for mayoral elections or city council elections. And that's without any threats. And so percentages like that, I think, are, again, fostered more by thinking that we, and analyses that we do in the West here of our own kind of electoral process. I think, you know, when all is said and done and we try and figure out how this all happened in Afghanistan, we need to factor in the particularly Afghan elements to this whole election to determine that. But, you know, the Westerners are saying 30% and things of that nature.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking about your days in the Peace Corps there and all that's happened in that country since the time that you were there. What a hard place to live, isn't it?
Yes, and I'll tell you, it's very bittersweet for me in many ways to see Afghanistan trying to, you know, regain its place in the world. When I lived there, first time I went in 1964 with the Peace Corps, and then you know, it was an ideal kind of place to live as a foreigner, particularly because it was going through this new constitutional period in Afghanistan in which people were voting and participating. And so as a young Peace Corps volunteer, I felt very, enthused being able to participate in such a dramatic, turn in one country's history. And as I said before, you know, it was an exceedingly hospitable climate. It was a wonderful place to live, really. That's why, again, I kept going back 10 years almost in totality. And but now, you know, everything is trying to reconstruct. Every effort is part of the reconstruction. So there's such an overwhelming number of foreigners trying to help the Afghans out, both in terms of restoring security and also in restoring the infrastructure and the brain trust of that country. Sometimes in certain sectors of that process, there are far too many of us, and we have a negative impact on the inflationary circumstances in Afghanistan economically. We create gridlock in terms of policy. And yet you see things in person like Christiane Amanpour registered and her show where the enthusiasm of the Afghan youth and as well their parents and other members of the society rebuilding or reconstructing, painting their homes or their shops, getting their lives back in order. That's all very heartening. But at this stage, it's, you know, in reflection upon those years in which, you know, I lived there with my wife and we had a child there, our firstborn, and I coached that basketball team. You know, in many ways, I was an idyllic kind of opportunity for an American to go abroad and follow the instruction of John F. Kennedy. I couldn't think of a better place. And I'm telling you, Kathleen, if you talk to anybody who served in the Foreign Service in Afghanistan, they will almost invariably say, serving during that time, that that was the highlight of their experience. It's kind of like Julia Child's experience in Paris, you know, with the with her husband in the diplomatic corps, how much that meant to her. Serving in Afghanistan during that time was just a wonderful experience. Everywhere you went in the country, there were history, you know, Alexander passed through here. Kandahar, for example, the city that we hear so much in the news, that name is derived from Alexander's name, Iskandar in Persian. And, you know, because he went there at one time, built a citadel. And so there's so much history, tremendous scenery, and that hospitality. It was a great place to be.
That hospitality, it means a lot. Thanks, Art, for your call. We go to Sue next from Duluth. Hi, Sue.
Hello.
Hi.
I would like to, this is very shallow compared to the depth and seriousness of most of what's being discussed, but I was wondering if the guest could say the same sentence in the three dialects of Farsi that he knows. For example, I'm going to the store for milk and bread or something.
Well, I can try that. The way to do it in Dari in Afghan Persian is Mabudukan Barai Shiru Non Merum Digad. But and in Iranian Persian, my pronunciation isn't as great in Iranian Persian as it is in Afghan Persian, but it would be kind of like Ma ba dukan meruim. In other words, they instead of saying meruim, they say meruim, and but I noon u shir. So and in Tajikistan, it's almost exactly the same. The difference in Tajikistan with Persian is that it's written in a Cyrillic script, in other words, Russian script. So in Afghanistan, in Iran, Persian is written in Arabic script. The uniqueness of all this is that Persian language, whether it's Farsi in Iran, Dari in Afghanistan, or Tajiki in Tajikistan, is an Indo-European language, but it's written in two of those countries, Iran and Afghanistan, in the Arabic script, and in Tajikistan in Russian script. So it makes it a little more interesting. So I did study Russian. That's what helped me to be able to read and write, you know, Tajiki, not as well as I do Persian script in Arabic. But the poetry and the literature of Persian extends over all three of those countries.
That's amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. So
not at all a shallow question. It's important and I always like to ensure that when I make presentations that I talk about the rich cultural traditions and history of a place like Afghanistan. We see it only in the news today, undergoing so much travail and difficulty, and it looks dusty and dirty, but there are so many wonderful places in that country, and the history is so rich. The language, there's more poetry in Persian as one of the rich Indo-European languages than there are in almost any of the others, particularly in the European, you know, golden eras combined. It's just a very strong oral tradition, poetically minded culture. And some of the poet laureates of Turkey and India, whose peoples are not, you know, Persian or Persian origins are still from Persian poets because of the extent. It was the kind of internet of the globalization highway along the Silk Road of ancient times. Persian was the primary language of communication. That's why the Alexander came to Asia. He was trying to gain control of that Silk Road. That's why Cyrus left Asia and went to Greece. He was trying to gain a hold of the terminal sectors of that Silk Road. And the language that was the prominent one in commerce at that time, throughout that period, was Persian.
Thank you so much for your call. We'll take more in a moment. Today, the Afghan elections for president of the country, and we're talking about Afghanistan this hour of the program with the best possible guest. Tom Goodyear is Dean of International Studies and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. His ties to the country go way back to the mid-60s when he was a Peace Corps volunteer in the country, and we're welcoming your phone calls. We also have an email address if you'd like to use that. That is talk@wpr.org and the number 800-486-8655. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program today, Tears in the Darkness, the story of the Bataan Death March and its aftermath. Back to phone calls. Dennis is next from Racine. Hi, Dennis.
Oh, hi. I was interested in the poppy trade. It's flourishing in Afghanistan. Most of the world's heroin comes from there. But it wasn't always that way. And I know that when the Taliban was in charge, I think they outlawed it. And in that respect, maybe the world was better off. But what was it like when your guest was in the Peace Corps? Were there poppy fields, and was there a market for the drug trade through the poppy fields then?
Well, that's a good question, and I enjoy having the opportunity to respond to that. And by the way, Kathleen, thank you for letting me go on about that Persian language and stuff.
Oh, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it, really. It was fun.
You know, as you can tell, I get excited about that. I can tell you, Dennis, that when I lived in Afghanistan in those 10-year period, I never saw a field of poppies growing anywhere, okay?
Really?
And that all started to develop, as you correctly pointed out, at a later period. And that started to develop in Afghanistan during the period when the Soviets were occupying the country. There are large tracts of the country that became lawless, not under state control. And of course, that's the best kind of environment for lawless activity, whether it's drug lords or warlords or whatever have you. The that 1 year that you mentioned in which the Taliban outlawed the cultivation of poppies, actually, the poppies continued to be cultivated to a certain degree, and most of that was more a market kind of readjustment than an adjustment under principle. And it was built up, I think, as a decision having to do with principle more than it actually was. And that's because the whole narco business apparatus was so powerful and had so much money that it was able to make things function or fluctuate within the country as it wished. But I always enjoy, literally, being able to tell people that before these 30-some years of travail in Afghanistan, there was not this opium poppy industry. And in that area where the opium poppies are most cultivated, and it's in the news more and more now, the Helmand province, was a province which the United States worked with the Afghans to help bring back to irrigation, and there was a tremendous amount of wheat cultivation there. It became the kind of breadbasket of Afghanistan, and it was during the period, as I said earlier, under the Soviets, where that all came apart. Largely, people started growing what they had to grow in order to survive, because there's no crop like the opium poppy. It can be cultivated up to 3 times a year in some parts of the country.
My.
And so it's very productive. And also it's very, very hardy. You don't need much water, and you only need manure. And there's a lot of that in a country that does so much animal husbandry. So, you know, what needs to be changed now is that you're not going to be able to transform it only by changing your crop. You have to change the economy in those areas where families are finding money, employment, in a variety of areas, as well as cultivating maybe wheat or pomegranates in and around Kandahar, which is a great pomegranate growing center at one time, nuts in areas north of there, grapes and raisins in areas north of Kabul, pistachios in the northwest of Afghanistan. So that can be done, but it needs to be a part of a broader changing the economy scheme.
Thanks for the call, Dennis. Randy is our next caller. Hi, Randy.
Yeah, hi. Say, I just have a question. I wish you could speak to something. In Farsi, I have a lady whose husband's expertise was Farsi and had served much like you. By the way, thank you for your service. I think you don't know the benefit to people like you now, those seeds that were sown then, how that might be now, why there's such a willingness. Don't the Farsi people have great long memories? And don't we have among these tribes, isn't that the one nation where we actually have some residual goodwill because of these efforts? And does that not mean, and this is what I want you to speak to, does that not mean that our government now would be well advised to go, when they go into, especially like Hellman, to actually first ask the tribal leaders, what do you need from us? If we attack this Taliban leader or whoever we suspect, that may be a good from our perspective, but is it what you want from us?
Hmm. Well, I think, you know, any attempt to rebuild the country and to bring Afghanistan to stability and to make it a partner in the United Nations and in the world's nations requires us to approach the Afghans like that. They understand very much, the world's mood and how it functions. I think they focus much more on it than we do on the rest of the world. Because it's their whole lives and futures are tied up in it. And so I think that's smart. I think we're starting to do that. I think it was Ray, right? And I appreciate the fact that we are trying to do that. I think that under Gates and Admiral Mullen and now General McChrystal, that this is part of the focus. And I've been noting that. I've been involved in some discussions that they've been having about that. And I think we're starting to get it. And that's very important for us in terms of our hope for success, as well as for the Afghans in their need for success.
It seems to me, though, that the other thing that we need to perhaps change, tell me what your thoughts are on this, is how we go about trying to uproot the insurgents, that we're missing the target. And my understanding is that that may draw people to the Taliban.
Well, I think that's correct, Kathleen. The fact is that there are certainly numbers of them there, particularly those that continue to go back and forth across the Afghanistan-Pakistan border, who are a part of a jihadi militant mentality, and there's nothing we're going to be able to do about reincorporating them into any kind of semblance of normal, stable, lifestyle. But there are many others, and we've seen this, I think, in recent months, people talking about going out and talking to some of the various insurgent groups. We talk about them as the Taliban, but there are many, many different kinds of Taliban, and they all have different issues, and some of their issues are very local. Some of them have issues because of past history and experiences, tribal rivalries, linguistic rivalries, and people just want to be reassured that they're not going to be subjected to inequities. And at a time when everybody's talking about elections and democracy and rule of law, and so they're insurgent. Some of them are insurgent because, as I said earlier, that's all they've known. And for them, it's a grand life adventure.
Mm-hmm.
They've never been able to settle into the responsibilities and the benefits of living, you know, out a normal kind of lifestyle. They've only been insurgents in some form or another.
On that note, we have to end. Tom, we're out of time. Thank you so much. You're a wonderful guest. Thank you.
Good to be with you, Kathleen.
Thank you. Thomas Goodyear, he is Dean of International Studies and Director of the Center for Afghanistan Studies at the University of Nebraska. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rob Schroeder and Jalema Noel for on-air production. We'll return.